The Alabama Crops Report Podcast, your trusted information source for Alabama agriculture.
Hey, everybody, welcome into the Alabama Crops Report Podcast. We're coming to you today, Halloween Day, Simmer. We're recording.
Yeah, it is.
How about that?
Yeah, we should have dressed up.
Well, we've got a pretty spooky topic to talk about.
Yeah. So. Hey, you could have come as a cover crop.
But which cover crop would I be?
What would that be?
If I were to pick any cover crop to be for Halloween, it would be Persian clover.
Persian clover.
Beautiful pink bloom. Not a very practical cover crop for Alabama because it blooms too late.
So I don't think I've ever heard of that one.
Yeah, it's a pretty one. And it smells delicious.
So if you don't remember, it's been a while since Dr. Audrey Gamble's been on the podcast. Now that she's a research teaching faculty, she doesn't do extension work anymore.
That's just not true.
glad to have you here, Audrey. All right, Chandler, what would you be if you were to be a cover crop?
So if I was to be a cover crop, I think I'd pick sun hemp because it's practical. It fixes nitrogen, but it also is tall, and I'm not a very tall person, so I'd like to be tall and be able to see over things.
Simmer, what would you be? Something you can spread with a drone?
I don't know too much about cover crops. I'll just say rye.
Rye.
It's a go-to.
All reliable.
Yeah. Yeah. About you?
I wouldn't be.
Yeah. So you're not participating in
what insect would you be?
I would be probably like a pea leaf weevil attracted to all those legume cover crops we got out there.
There we go.
This is going to be fun.
Yeah. All right. So, sorry, is this a timely topic to cover crops?
Absolutely. So okay. It's Halloween. Uh-huh. So we've gotten a good bit of our cover crop research trials in. I think for farmers, depending on what cash crop they're following, some cover crops have been planted in the state, and then, you know, following cotton, peanuts, soybean harvest, we'll have some more hopefully being planted soon.
What is our, for someone, like I said, I don't know too much about cover crops, just work here a little bit here and there. What is our timing for state of Alabama for planting or the season for cover crops usually?
So our timing for planting of cover crops is as soon as harvest ends, feasibly, you know, and this can be, for someone like you who's doing research with drones, like there can be ways for us to get in and plant cover crops ahead of harvest as well. But I would say for most of the state, as soon as we can plant after harvest, the earlier the better. A lot of the species that we grow, for example, crimson clover, any of the legumes, our ideal planting date for those is going to be mid to late October. So if we can get on time, that'll give us a lot better biomass and a lot better stand as we move into the spring. For some of the cover crops that we grow, though, like daikon radishes, for example, we want to get those even in earlier if we can. So those can be really good behind a corn rotation when we can actually plant them in late September and early October.
So is that something growers kind of also see or evaluate? If this is something going after corn, they might pick.
Yeah, they might. That would be one. I would say you could boil it down to more considerations, but three of the big considerations for determining what cover crops you're going to plant. Number one is going to be what benefits you're trying to get, right? So certain species are going to give you specific benefits. Another is going to be the timing of planting, because if we can't plant it on time where it actually gets good biomass production, then it's not worth the money. And then the third would be, and this is where Scott will come in, is, you know, what is our cash crop rotation? What pest cycles do we need to be concerned about breaking in order to, you know, prevent a buildup of nematodes or soil diseases for the following cash crop?
And also, what's your government check tied to?
That is a very good point. What is your government check tied to? Do you have to plant a multi-species cover crop? If you're planting with the NRCS, then that will come into play as well.
This is the conservation program and all that.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of industry programs now as well for cover crops. So depending on what the requirements are for a specific program to get a payment for those cover crops, that may come into play with species selection as well.
And that'll also determine your date, too. Sometimes there's a deadline that you have to get planted by, so sometimes you can't wait super late. Like if you're waiting for that timely rains, because that's another factor people weigh in on is, are we getting a rain soon? We've been pretty dry for the last couple of weeks, so planting something, if you weren't going to get the timely rains, it wouldn't grow and get good biomass. It may just sit there dormant. So sometimes people factor, do I want to spend the money on seed and diesel fuel to put it out there if I'm not going to get the rains?
Yeah. About the programs, now I'm somewhat aware about the government programs, but you said industry programs. What all, but also more importantly, for maybe some growers or other people who may not be aware, where do they find information on all that?
There are some government websites to kind of point to what programs are available in specific states. Or there will be.
They're all down right now.
Yeah. So that's why I hesitated to make a comment. But working with your local, you know, retailers as well, or buyers, there can be specific programs. A couple of examples, like the Soil Health Institute has a program to pay for cover crops. Golden Peanut has a program. And then some other industry have programs to help with the cost of cover crops, because it is an investment that is providing benefits to the broader public, and it's not, especially in the short term, providing an initial financial benefit to growers in a lot of cases. And so those programs are intended to offset some of that cost, to help get cover crops in the rotation and start building some of the benefits in terms of soil health that you would want to achieve with cover crops.
Gotcha. What is our adoption of cover crops in Alabama?
This is a tough question to answer, and the best data comes from probably either the Ag Census. There was also some good data when, after COVID, there were some payments for cover crops that went out, and it hovers somewhere between around 17% to 25% of row crop acres that are planted in cover crops in the state.
Oh, would that include wheat or no?
That would not include wheat for harvest.
Okay.
I thought for some reason it would be more.
And we're, I would say, you know, fairly, when you look at the, I don't remember what place we are in terms of the state of Alabama, but relatively high for the U.S.
For the U.S.
I was back home this weekend or this week, and rode through a pretty significant part of the Mississippi Delta, and it was beautiful. Everything was all the land was prepped, pre-emergent herbicides were, you know, fall pre's were put out.
When
no
you said beautiful,
no
with
cover.
A lot of cover
he
crops.
Loves some bare
just
bare
soil. Everything was already hipped and bedded, ready for next
so
year.
We can say Mississippi's cover crop adoption less than 5%.
Well, I can't say that, but it's not very high in the Delta. I'm sure it's a lot more in the hills where you need to hold the soil there, right? But in the Delta, where you control the grading of every single field, how sloped it is, runoff, erosion is not as big a deal.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, I think to your point, the reason I said that joke was that I do think 17% to 25% is probably a pretty high adoption in the South. Anyway, I don't know about the Midwest, but
I think peanuts kind of may affect that for a good bit for us, right?
It does. There's less cover crops. Not to say that there's no cover crops that are going ahead of peanuts, but there's less cover crops going into peanuts. But I like your point about highly erodible land. There's different reasons that we plant cover crops, and every farm is different, and every farm has to figure out what's going to work best for them. But if we don't have soil to farm in the future, then, you know, insect control doesn't matter if we don't have the soils to grow the crops. And if we lose that land, if we lose that soil, it takes hundreds of years for 1 inch of topsoil to form. And so if once we lose it, we can't get it back. So a lot of times we'll talk about it takes several years to see the benefits of cover crops to accrue in terms of building soil health. But on the inverse side of that, if we're losing a lot of soil to erosion, we're going to see degradation in the long term of that soil as well. So it's not only a building of soil for the long term, but also an avoiding of degradation of soil in the long term.
That's a good point. Is our, going back to the adoption thing, I know our agriculture is kind of so diverse, or even like where we have North Alabama, even Tennessee Valley, and then Central and South. from the, and we usually, when we talk about row crops or something, we discuss like, well, it depends on what part of the state are we talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Does that also kind of apply to some extent to how the cover crops are being grown, managed across the state?
Yeah, it does. And just thinking about what species are grown, because we've done a lot of surveys of the reasons that farmers plant cover crops. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the southern portion of the state, if you're in the coastal plain, the top two reasons tend to be soil moisture retention and weed suppression.
Okay.
Those tend to be the top two goals. If we're in, and not to say that those aren't important in the Tennessee Valley, for example, but you see more in terms of trying to build overall soil health, reduce soil compaction is a really big one. I would say in the Tennessee Valley, moisture retention can be a double-edged sword in some soil types because it can hinder planting if we've got cover crop residue out at cash crop planting. And we see that a lot in the Tennessee Valley, or especially in the Black Belt, where if we've got heavy rainfalls and a lot of residue out, it can be too wet to get in a plant. You want that moisture eventually, you just don't want it when you're trying to get in the field.
Yeah, and not to mention all the... I usually say most of our planters are not normally equipped or set up to plant in cover crops or even heavy residue or something. So that even requires considerations on changing your planter setups in order to get the crop in.
Yeah. And that's part of the investment. We can talk about the cost of seed and the cost of chemical to terminate a cover crop. But if you're switching your system, that's a much larger investment. You know, maybe it requires different tillage equipment as well. And so to get started with cover crops, it can have a significant cost associated with it.
Yeah.
And you also, most of the wheat production would be in the Tennessee Valley.
Yes.
Also.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that would impact their adoption of cover crops because they're, mm-hmm. which this year I think wheat's supposed to be down. It's been down the last couple of years, but I think this year it's going to again. So they may grow more rye or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So you said earlier mid-October or early to mid-October for some of the, like, the best timing wise?
So depending on what you're planting.
Okay.
And I would even say for a lot of this, so our small grains are going to be our big cover crop species.
Mm-hmm.
Our rye, oat, triticale, wheat. And those, yeah, getting in this time of year is great. We can often get really good cover crop biomass, though, even planting well into November. And the further you go, the riskier it gets, but even into December as well. And if the weather cooperates, there is still potential to get a good biomass, even in under late planting. There are some variety selections that farmers can make to help minimize that risk. So, for example, some earlier maturing varieties of rye and oat can help to provide some benefit in terms of risk aversion if we're planting late. So mm-hmm. we've seen that varieties, for example, like Florida 401 rye, that's a very early mature, performs better when we plant it late, when we compare it to some of the typical rye cover crop varieties like Elbon or Renzabruzzi.
So as a grower, how do I kind of make that decision, or what helps them make that decision on? Because I've even heard like about a single species, two mm-hmm. and three species mixes and all that. Like, if a grower is making that decision, or if someone's just planting rye and they want to like consider maybe going into mm-hmm. looking into some other species and stuff, how do they kind of make that?
So yeah, the economics will come into play heavily. So okay. what's available in your region? I'm always happy to talk to people about, you know, seed availability and what suppliers sell specific varieties. If they're looking for early varieties of small grains or even earlier varieties of legumes, that would fit in their system. Price of seed and what's available in their area will dictate some of that. But I do encourage people to think about species selection and think about variety selection intentionally instead of just going to the co-op and saying, you know, what do you have that we could plant as a cover crop? Because there's probably some benefit that you're trying to get out of that cover crop, and depending on what that benefit is or what pests that you have in your area, in your fields, some species selection may help you in the long term.
Could does the Henry's variety tool has information on that, or is that only for crop, he right? Had
so there are a lot of species that we grow as cover crops, included. So Henry has small grain variety trials for forage, and he has small grain variety trials for grain. Mm-hmm. And so the especially the ones for forage can give an idea of the biomass production for certain varieties as well as maturity. But it's important to remember that in those variety trials for grazing, it's being managed a lot differently. So the seeding rates are going to be higher, the nitrogen fertility rates are going to be higher, because we're putting more inputs into forages in order to get more yeah. feed produced. So those the variety trials can be useful. The Henry's variety trials, the OVT trials, they can be very useful. Just know that that's one caveat, is that there's a higher level of management. We've also done some multi-state cover crop variety trials over the past 4 years. And that effort is led by Virginia Sykes at University of Tennessee. And mm-hmm. we've had locations in Alabama since that variety trial started. And those are available if you just search Southern cover crop variety trials. That will be the first item that comes up. And there will be information in terms of about the biomass that's produced with different cover crop species. And then there's also some data for certain locations on weed suppression and nitrogen credits as well. So that can be a useful tool to look at, or document to look at.
Okay.
What before Chandler started, but you've got a really good extension fact sheet or whatever on the different types of cover crops, mm-hmm. right, and what benefits they provide and those kinds of things on the extension website.
Yeah, if you search cover crops for Alabama, that should be the first document that comes up. And that was initially written by Dennis Delaney, who's a retired extension specialist, and Kit Balcom, and Arnold Kaler, who is a retired research station director. So they initially wrote that article, and it's been updated throughout the years. It has some information about benefits, seeding rates, planting dates, all of that good stuff.
Okay. So given we are October 31st, let's say this episode comes out within a week, what are some things right now that the growers should be considering given the time of the year and where we are, you know?
Making it a priority to get it out early, and it's hard. I understand it's hard because there's so many different operations going on at the farm this time of year, but making it a priority to get it out as timely as possible is, you know, once you're hearing this, because Kit Balcom, who's with the USDA RS lab, has done a lot of research on planting dates of cover crops, and particularly rye. And so the later we get, so let's say we have kind of four planting dates that we're looking at, starting with mid-October, mm-hmm. and then we've got early November, late November, and early December as our cover crop planting date options. If we plant a cover crop in mid-October with no nitrogen, mm-hmm. we will get approximately the same biomass as a cover crop that is planted in December with 90 pounds of nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
That 90 pounds of nitrogen is a much higher cost for the producer. So we can make up for biomass by applying nitrogen, but that's expensive, and we typically don't want to do that. So by getting out particularly small grain cover crops on time or as early as possible, we start to get some of that biomass benefit without having to spend any money. And if we're looking for a benefit like weed suppression or moisture retention where you have to have high biomass,
mm-hmm.
Then you need to make that biomass production a priority if that's your goal. Talking about moisture retention, weed suppression, those benefits that really require a high biomass.
So do growers have these nitrogen credits and all that kind of figured out in a way of like, hey, I'm planting this because I'm going into this cash crop next season. Hopefully I'll get this. Do they deduct that from your fertility program?
So you're talking about, do they deduct nitrogen from their cash crop from what they put on their cover crop?
No, from the cover.
From
making the decision.
So if I know I'm planting
corn next year.
I'm planting corn and I have a clover cover crop.
Okay.
I expect this much nitrogen out of it.
Okay. Oh, so now we're on legumes, which is different nitrogen benefit. And this one is, but let me go back to that other topic really quick before we move on and say cover crops are rarely going to get more than 30 pounds of nitrogen put out on them. Okay. So if you're planting late, there's probably going to be some biomass penalty.
And when does, just be aware when of that. Does that nitrogen go out on the cover crop?
So Kip, I'm shouting out to Kip again because he's done some research looking at fall application versus spring application. And in general, the fall applications, you know, do just as good in terms of getting that biomass produced for the cover crop as spring. Okay, so now talking about legumes, and Chandler has done a lot of work with legumes as well. Clover and vetch and some of the other legumes that we plant, we can get up to about 30 to 50 pounds of nitrogen per acre credit by following a crimson clover or a hairy vetch cover crop. The benefit, the likelihood of getting that nitrogen credit is increased by waiting until we have maximum biomass production. Mm-hmm. So for corn, that can be difficult because if we think about when we're planting corn and when legumes like crimson clover are producing their biomass, they're producing the majority of that biomass in late March and early April. So if we're terminating it in early March, we're missing a lot of that. So if we want the nitrogen credit, then letting it get to full bloom is going to be important. There are other agronomic considerations to make when you're deciding when to plant corn, but just solely focusing on getting a nitrogen credit, then we need to wait until it reaches maximum biomass production. Also, minimizing the time frame between termination and planting will help us to get that credit. So if we terminate, you know, let's say we do wait until mid-April mm-hmm. to terminate our legume cover crop, but then we don't plant our cash crop, let's say cotton, until mid-May, we've had a lot of time for that nitrogen to be lost between termination and planting. Through, you know, if we get rainfall, it can leach, it can volatilize, or it can denitrify and enter the atmosphere. And so keeping that window narrower will help to maximize the likelihood of
what's
getting
the
a nitrogen credit.
Time?
So for cotton, we don't... Scott's input needed here. Okay. Cotton, we do like to have 2 weeks just to prevent a green bridge. But in corn, in general, a lot of times if we plant corn green into a living cover crop, you may have some specific insect issues that could be a problem. But we do that quite a bit on the research stations where we plant corn directly into a living cover crop and then terminate it and you know get a good benefit out of that in terms of nitrogen. What do you want to say, Scott?
He's been quiet today.
2 to 3 weeks.
2 to 3 weeks. Okay. Now, you said the nitrogen benefit only comes from, like, hay vetch and crimson clover.
Any legumes, but those are the two that are going to be the most consistent in terms of production in Alabama. Those are the reliable.
Yeah. But what the point I was trying to make was... Isn't most of our the most widely planted cover crop is rye?
Mm-hmm.
So, are there any nitrogen benefits associated with that at all?
No, there's the opposite. But that's okay. It depends on what benefits you're trying to get. But if we've got rye, you've got a material with a very high carbon and nitrogen ratio, mm-hmm. which means it's going to actually tie up. It could tie up some nitrogen. So, for let's say we're following a high biomass cover crop of rye with corn. We probably want to put a little bit more of our nitrogen out at plant in order to prevent some of that immobilization or tying up of nitrogen by the rye cover crop. Chandler, I know you've done a lot of research with living mulches, so that's legumes that are planted and cash crops directly planted into those. So what's your take on legumes and living mulches for nitrogen benefits?
So yeah, legumes and living mulches, because I also have experience from like the Midwest, and so green planting is very common practice up there, because like that waiting that time period, we want to get maximum thing, and just due to the seasonality it just collides too much. But we also do all that same time planting. So when we do talk about living mulches, perennial ground covers, so what we do is we have like a clover growing out there, it's fixing the nitrogen, it's we can get 50 to 60 pounds in some of that white clover nitrogen credits. And so what we do is we spray out a strip 1 foot wide, and then we plant into the center of that. So we use precision technology to spray using a hooded sprayer or banded spraying, and then we use a planter that's sitting on the back on that same GPS row and planting right back into it. So that way you get take advantage of that nitrogen right away and you plant right away. You don't have to worry about the volatilization and the losses of that for the nitrogen. Also, that living mulch is still growing, but it's also slowly dying off throughout the season. And as it's dying back and throughout the season from the cash crop shading it out, it actually is providing nutrients once again to it slowly as it breaks down over time. So it's kind of a little bit different take on it. I know it provides a potential issue for insects as it's living all the time. It's always growing out there, but it does have the great benefits of providing the nitrogen. So through my work, we always planted cotton into the living mulches and we actually didn't supplement the nitrogen. We weren't going for maximum bales of cotton per acre, but we were going for maximum profit. So we were trying to put out the cover crop. It fixes all the nitrogen, so that way we don't have to buy urea. I also have worked on some stuff looking at potassium. So what we notice when we're using that for a long term, that system, we're talking about investment in these systems for a long run. So when you invest in that system for a long run, we noticed that potassium was being held in the system and it wasn't leaching out. So all the mother nutrients weren't leaching out of the system. They're being held in place. And when you're holding in place, you could actually slowly over time cut back on your potassium fertilization. So you kind of get multiple benefits out of using that cover crop where, you know, in the traditional system, you know, you still got that summertime where you could still leach out because the crop hasn't taken it off yet. Or when you talk about the timings of the cereal rice, that was always our comparison because that is like the status quo a lot of times for what people like to compare to because there's so much work in it. It does a lot of great benefits. It does cover the ground, hold the moisture. But like Audrey was talking about, it could tie up nutrients. And so sometimes people got to factor that into what is your goal. And so that's kind of some of the, what I like to talk about with people.
How many growers are actually doing the living or not living, even planting into green and all that in the South?
Not a lot. In terms of a true living mulch. But I do know, you know, in terms of planting green, especially with a legume, it's more common than if you were doing it with a rye, for example, or a small grain. I even know of a couple of producers that maybe they plant a cover crop mixture that includes a grass and a legume, and they'll actually go in with a grass herbicide, terminate the rye, and then let the legume continue to flourish to get that nitrogen benefit. But I do understand the caveat, like know what pests might be an issue in your field, because there could be some potential insects to look out for if you've got that green bridge.
And there's also, outside of insects, there's room for error with your planter setup as well.
That's
right. You got to make sure you do that right, or you're not going to get good seed placement, and you're going to have a poor stand.
That's something I've noticed, just a little bit of experience I have on planters with cover crops and all that, and this was all like Southeast Georgia. There was a pretty big adoption of cover crops in that part of the state. And then you go to some farmers, and these guys have kind of modified their planters in such a way that they are able to get the seed in the ground, get this proper seed depth and even seeding rate and stuff. And where we always talk about some other growers who are just trying to use the normal planter to plant, they're like, well, I'm always having issues this and that. And that's where I've seen like some of these crazy modifications done, you know, where you have so much heavy toolbar, even bunch of roller crimping units mounted in front of the planter and stuff like that. So it definitely a lot of consideration to that.
Yeah, if you're going to plant green, you got to take a little bit of time and investment and do it right if you're going to do it.
What would you say are the biggest insects to be on the lookout for that time of year following?
Well, it partly would depend on what type of cover crop. There's a lot of insects that are attracted to legumes. Peat leaf weevil is one of the big ones. And so if you're planting soybeans behind a legume cover crop, that's one that we're really concerned about. But then also things like wireworms, rootworms, you know, those kind of soil insects, that's mostly what we're concerned about. Something that we don't know yet, Chandler, but we're going to get some information hopefully this winter, is cotton jacet. What's it going to survive on? What's it not going to survive on? Is it going to survive the winter at all? We don't know. As we talked today, it got down to 38 or so at Prattville. And so Blake is supposed to be going to the station to see how well did the jacets do last night. My guess is they'll be just fine, but we're going to go see. But so that's something that we just don't know. My gut says if there's anything they probably won't do very well on, it's the grasses. And so that's mostly what we plant, I think, is rye or oats or whatever. So that will probably help. But yeah, for that, we just don't know right now.
Since we don't know, and this has come up a few times, even in our podcast for last at least two or three times about the Jacid situation and maybe the cover crops this fall, all that. Since we don't know yet what's going to happen, how they're going to all that, are we suggesting changing anything from normally what the growers do?
Maybe. So the philosopher Francis Bacon, have you ever heard of Francis Bacon?
Yeah.
From the like,
18,
Sir Francis Bacon, yeah.
Sir Francis Bacon from a long time ago. He had a quote. I won't use the old English version. I'll use the Mississippi version. But it goes along the lines of, few things make a man suspect much than to know little. And right now we're doing a lot of suspecting. With this thing. We've learned a lot in a short amount of time, but there's still stuff like this, like that question, we just can't know.
Yeah.
So I know Philip Roberts at Georgia is telling folks to consider ripping stalks, cotton stalks.
Go right behind it.
Yeah, and I'm...
Mowing or ripping?
Ripping them out.
So like a shredder puller or something.
Yeah, I'm not quite there yet. Just mow them down as low as you can, and the frost is going to kill that eventually, you know, most places. But he might be right. I don't know. That's just a big investment. I don't know how many people were even set up to rip stalks anymore. Probably not many.
No, that's why I said KMC make these special or whatever those instruments, you know, stalk pullers and stuff that you actually got to run through. And whereas mowing, you just take a mower, right? Like a big.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You just take a bush hog. And, yeah. You got to do that anyway. That's, you know, it's part of boll weevil irad. But so, yeah, we don't know. I've even talked with people about, should we go ahead and spray a herbicide on these, on the regrowth now and kill it? And I'm like, well, maybe. That's just another added trip across the field, more herbicides to spray. So we just don't know. So right now, I'm not necessarily recommending we go add a whole bunch of expense and do different stuff that we don't normally do because we don't know if it'll matter or not.
Yeah. So follow your normal approach, whatever you've been
doing in the past years. I suspect so.
All right. Well, we got just a few minutes here. I guess anything else important you guys want to touch on related to cover crop considerations, where we are in the season, and we could probably do maybe another podcast if needed, you know, later.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to do one in the spring, talking about killing cover crops. maybe get David Russell in to talk about burn down and that kind of thing.
What would be the best time to do it? So let's say given a week timeline to get it posted, all that.
Termination? Oh, it depends on what cash crop you're going into and the benefits. But I would say most cover crops are being terminated in the month of April.
April, yeah. All right.
And in March.
One thing I am suggesting we change with cotton is planting earlier, and so that would play into that. If you got decent soil temps and moisture around April 15th, I'd start planting cotton next year. So
April 15th?
April 15th. They can at a lot of years, they can get by with that in the Tennessee Valley.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
But we don't start here until about the first week of May.
First week. There's some of it's planted around the 20th of April, but the majority of it is planted the first 2 weeks of May.
Yeah.
But we suspect early planted cotton is going to have less pressure early season than later planted cotton from Jacids. Yeah. We suspect that. So that's one thing we are going to recommend. So that, again, that might change your timing of when you're going to start terminating cover crops. It might not.
Yeah. What other, I guess the last kind of thing, maybe if y'all are aware about, I think it would be good maybe to mention, what are some of the resources, information available on our websites or somewhere that the growers can go access and could gain some of this information as well?
So the Cover Crops for Alabama is one publication on our website. I'll make a plug for the Southern Cover Crops Council as well. So that's a group of researchers, farmers throughout the southern region of the U.S., and we will also be having a cover crop conference in February, late February in Gainesville, Florida. So that we usually have very good attendance from producers, and we have a lot of producer panels and producer speakers to talk about their experience for cover crops, with cover crops and what's been working on their farm. I always learn a ton from the producers at that meeting. So if you're interested, go check out the Southern Cover Crops Council website as well. And yeah, I'll also plug, because we have the USDA National Soil Dynamics Lab here in Auburn. They have a lot of good web resources as well, talking about different cover crop species.
And you also do your cover crop field days.
Oh yeah, me and Chandler have some cover crop field days to plan for the spring. We just set the date for the wiregrass cover crop field day for March 6th. But other than that, I think it's March 6th. Other than that, we'll have to plan for some field days in different parts of the state.
Yeah, there'll be that one. There'll be a couple other ones down in the South region. I've been working with some different groups and different interests, because there's a lot of different stakeholders, like we talked about earlier, like the Soil Health Institute. There's also the Sand County Foundation, which is a similar organization that's also very interested in cover crops, and they work throughout the South here. And there's some other ones that have been reaching out, and so I've been working with different people, because there's many different stakeholders, many different producers that are interested in using cover crops but new to it and trying to learn, especially with this cotton jazz that, like Scott talked about. We'll have some of that information hopefully available in the spring too, some of the early observations, not all the way, but some early observations going through. And so we'll have different meetings throughout the springtime that we're starting to plan, like Audrey talked about. We'll have that one in Headland. And then we'll also have some other ones up in the Tennessee Valley area and some throughout the state that we're starting to work on planning. That's why I can't share the dates yet, but once we get the venue locked down, we'll be able to share them.
Okay, good deal.
Spooky stuff.
Yeah.
And also, while we're on topic of meetings, the 13th Alabama Row Crop Short Course will be in Prattville January 20th and 21st. So get that, start talking about that song.
Yeah.
Registration coming soon. If you register before January 11th, it's free. How about that?
Oh, what's after that?
$40 after
that. Oh, man. That's a way to save $40.
That's right, yeah. All right, well, Audrey, Chandler, appreciate y'all's time today and information. Always good to have y'all on the Alabama Row Crops podcast. As always, if any of us with Alabama Extension could be of any help, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know.
The Alabama Crops Report is a production of the Alabama Cooperative Extension System.